Good morning. This is the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program is intended for a blind and print impaired audience. This is Bob Martin, and we're here again reading from this week's Independent, dated Wednesday, November 21st, 2018. We begin with the news section. Party's over. Democrats dominated the midterms in Wake County. Can the GOP bounce back? The last Wake County Republican in state office, State Senator John Alexander Jr., campaigns on the fact his wife is a Democrat. In a 2014 ad, John and Susan Alexander stand smiling in their kitchen saying, while they don't agree on everything, they both believe in raising teacher pay and investing in education. Plus, he's got this Democrat to hold him accountable, Susan says, handing John a bag of trash. Alexander's district swipes into the more rural and conservative Franklin County, cresting three country clubs. Even so, he won this year by fewer than 2,500 votes. Alexander is among a dying breed in Wake County, the endangered species of conservative politicians being driven out by urban demographics and a general disdain for President Trump, experts say. Out of 16 partisan state House and Senate races that include Wake County, Alexander is the only Republican left standing. The midterms also saw an ouster of longtime Republican Sheriff Donnie Harrison and Republican Clerk of the Superior Court Jennifer Knox, the re-election of Democratic District Attorney Lauren Freeman, and a Republican-free Wake County Board of Commissioners. So what, if anything, can the Wake County Republicans do to stage a comeback? Get our heads out of our butts, suggests Brent Woodcox, a Republican attorney and special counsel for the General Assembly. Republicans have been losing ground in Wake County since at least 2014, when Democrats retook the previously GOP-controlled Board of Commissioners. But changes in the county's demographics, trending toward a more diverse and educated voter base, have been underway for much longer. Wake's population has more than doubled since 1990, when whites made up 76% of the county's 423,380 residents. Now whites comprise just 61% of the county's million residents as of 2014, and over half of Wake residents have attended college. This demographic in particular, and especially college-educated women, have moved dramatically toward the Democratic Party, says North Carolina State Political Science Professor Stephen Green. Wake County is an area with a lot of white, college-educated voters. As long as that trend just maintains, this is basically a one-party county. In a sense, this is more evidence of the state's and the country's growing urban-rural divide. But a closer look paints a more nuanced picture. Wake's blue nose is concentrated in its urban core, where Democrats like Yvonne Lewis-Holly and Rosa Gill snagged nearly 80% of the votes each. It's more diluted toward the outskirts, which had some of the closest legislative races. Incumbent State Representative John B. Adcock, whose district spans Fuquay-Varina, lost by fewer than 800 votes to Democrat Sidney Batch. Longtime State Representative Nelson Dollar lost to Julie Van Hafen by fewer than 1,000 votes. His district encompasses part of Apex and stretches toward Holly Springs. These communities are the real battlegrounds, says Duke political scientist Mac McCorkle, who describes these towns as countrypolitan, caught between a rural legacy and a suburban future. Those areas aren't really rural anymore in any way that you can define, McCorkle says. Their legacies might be rural, but more of those people are commuting in or working in factory or desk jobs. They are not out in the field anymore. It's these in-between countrypolitan places that have rural legacies but are connected to the city in some way that are contested areas. If Republicans hope to regain traction in Wake, they'll need to target those districts. To succeed, McCorkle says, They'll need to distance themselves from state and national politics, or more simply, they need to dump Trump. Democrats' success in Wake really was, in the end, a rejection of Trump, McCorkle says. Whether it was a rejection of Republicanism, that remains to be seen. But I think the Republicans are worried that it could have been. There's this growing perception that these guys aren't about really governing and doing things for the state of North Carolina. It's about how can they get more manipulation of power. National politics have become so polarized, Green adds, that most races are predetermined by districting and the R or D that appears on the ballot next to a candidate's name. But in close races, reputation and campaign rhetoric can make a difference and may have helped Alexander hang on. To win as a Republican in Wake County, you have to talk about certain things like education that are going to appeal to more Democratic voters, Green says. If Alexander had run as a high-core Tea Party Republican, he would have lost. Any Republicans who want to win anything in Wake County are going to run as more moderate Republicans. For Woodcox, Wake Republicans need to reinvigorate the party with younger candidates and tell a better story that connects with voters. That could involve advocating for cutting red tape on issues like accessory dwelling units that Raleigh Democrats have dragged their feet on. Republicans need to take a long look inside and understand that the county is changing, and it's changing very quickly, and the party is not changing as quickly as the county is. The message that the party has been running on for a long time just isn't relevant enough with the voters who are voting in these elections, and we're not connecting with them. Now, hopefully, they've hit rock bottom and can turn things around and start to think differently. The next article, down to the wire. As deadline loomed, DPS kept some custodians in the dark about whether they still had jobs. Last week, custodians contracted to work in Durham Public Schools convinced officials to bring their service in-house, making them school system employees with better pay, better benefits, and more job security. DPS were preparing to make the transition in less than 2 weeks, and for at least a few custodians, it's been a nail-biting wait to find out if they'll still have jobs come the end of November. Longtime custodians Deborah Bailey and Gloria Howard made their case before the Board of Education last week, saying that as loyal employees, they shouldn't be left to wonder if they'll soon be out of work. The 30th of this month, I will be out of work and won't even have a place to stay, Howard told the board between tears, prompting school board member Matt Sears to step down from the dais, put his arm around her, and quietly tell her everything would be all right. School board members then ask a representative to speak to Howard in the hall, and since then, Human Resources has gotten in contact with her about her employment. Similarly, since speaking to the board on Thursday, Bailey has been recommended for her old job at the Beacon Street Central Services Building, a position she's held for most of the 10 years she had been contracted by Service Solutions. But the whole process left Howard Bailey and others questioning why they had to wait so long to learn if they had jobs. Bailey, who was a vocal proponent of bringing custodial services in-house and who served on a 3-member transition committee, wondered whether her advocacy had something to do with it, but said if speaking up on behalf of others meant losing her job, so be it. Despite her role organizing the school custodians, it was the first time that she had said publicly that her employment was unsure. I just turned 65. I can go home, she said. Howard questioned whether favoritism was the reason she wasn't immediately recommended for a job, one that she'd held for 14 years. Prior to being told a few weeks ago that she was being put out the building at Githens Middle School, Howard said her hours had been changed, leaving her less time than other custodians had to clean their classrooms. She missed 3 days of work until the principal helped her get a job picking up trash in Hillside Hills High School and made sure she was paid for the days she was without work. Howard told the board that teachers at Githens Middle School, where she cleaned for the past 2.5 years, even signed a petition that she be able to stay at the school. Githens principal, Crystal Isamadu, told the Indy she wasn't aware of a petition, but said Howard does have an outstanding job, and staffers are extremely supportive of her. "I should have been one of the first hired," Howard told the school board. Arasi Adkins, assistant superintendent over human resources, told the board after Howard's and Baylor's remarks that these stories are certainly the exception. Durham Public Schools is proud to have rapidly invested in ending outside contracting of the custodial services and filling each position with a DPS employee, the school system said in a statement. "We have retained 100% of our current DPS custodians as DPS employees and have hired 97%, 94 out of 200, of our contracted service custodians. These numbers speak for themselves. We categorically reject any allegation of retaliation against employees or contract employees for sharing their thoughts about the process of bringing custodial services in-house." With a December 3rd deadline to have all custodial employees in place, these figures are changing regularly. Overall, the school system will hire about 270 custodians, as well as lead custodians and supervisors. The 31 custodians employed by Durham Schools will retain their jobs through the transition. According to Adkins, of those 31, 13 were lead custodians, and 18 held regular custodian positions. 10 of 13 lead custodians kept their same jobs. One was promoted to a custodial supervisor position, and 2 were demoted to custodian. In an Inset article, News Brief, Measuring Gerrymandering. According to an analysis by Raleigh statistician Marks Hardy and Democratic activist Joseph Huberman, Democratic congressional candidates in North Carolina wasted nearly a million more votes in this year's midterm election than Republicans did, causing Democrats to lose 10 of 13 races despite nearly splitting the statewide popular vote. Hardy and Huberman calculate that the state's congressional races produced a so-called efficiency gap of 27.46%, up from 19.3% in the 2016 elections, and high enough to indicate aggressive gerrymandering by the lawmakers who drew those districts. In this analysis, all the votes won by losing candidates and the votes in a winner receives over the majority needed to prevail are considered wasted. The efficiency gap is the difference between the two parties' wasted votes divided by the number of total votes. In the 2018 congressional elections in North Carolina, Republicans wasted 382,452 votes, while Democrats wasted 1,314,081 votes. In essence, this means Democrats won fewer seats by huge margins, while Republicans won many more seats by much smaller margins. According to a proposed standard set forth in a 2014 article in the University of Chicago Law Review, an efficiency gap should be no higher than 8% in districts that are fairly drawn. That threshold is controversial, but it provides judges with a tool to measure gerrymandering, something they hadn't had before. The U.S. Supreme Court hasn't yet ruled on whether partisan, as opposed to racial, gerrymandering is constitutional. With Brett Kavanaugh joining the court's conservative majority, it seems unlikely to do so. The North Carolina Supreme Court could be another story. Last week, Common Cause and the North Carolina Democratic Party filed a lawsuit in state court contending that the state's legislative districts amount to partisan gerrymanders, which it contends are illegal under the state constitution. With a 5-2 Democratic advantage on the state court, the plaintiffs seem likely to prevail, and a lawsuit challenging the congressional district seems destined to follow. The efficiency gap is likely to be central to the plaintiffs' arguments in those cases. It's possible, if not likely, that the state Supreme Court will order both legislative and congressional districts redrawn before the 2020 election, and that could give Democrats a fighting chance at retaking the state House or the Senate. That, in turn, should have huge ramifications, as the next General Assembly will draw the district lines used for the next decade. From the Soapboxer column, a sucker's game, how Amazon played us. In the end, Amazon did what Amazon was always going to do, that bachelorette-style competition that saw 238 cities across the country prostrate themselves before Jeff Bezos in hopes of winning the beautiful rose of HQ2. It didn't matter. What mattered was that Amazon got the publicity it wanted, with eager municipalities fawning over the company for months on end. Raleigh put on Seattle buses, and North Carolina spent at least $92,000 on a campaign, T-shirts, social media, to convince Amazon to cast a flirtatious glance in our direction. Other cities went further. Chicago paid William Shatner to narrate its proposal video, as Bezos is a Trekkie. A small Georgia city offered to name itself Amazon if it prevailed. Everyone, even in the most progressive bastions, conveniently forgot the horror stories that have emerged from Amazon's warehouses or its rapacious union busting. Amazon, after all, was offering 55,000 high-paying jobs and $5 billion in total investment. It would have been a game-changer, especially for mid-sized cities like Raleigh. Alas, Amazon's interest was all for show, because what mattered even more than Amazon's publicity coup is that, having 238 cities bid on the project, and then by dangling the 20 finalists, including Raleigh, on the line for a year, Amazon extracted the incentives it wanted from New York and Arlington, Virginia, which split the honor of being Amazon's choice. All it cost them was $2 billion, $1.5 billion from New York, $573 million from Virginia. The triangle was never really in the running. In fact, those behind our region's bid hadn't heard from the company since June, a few months after they wined and dined company officials at Ashley Christensen's death and taxes. With Amazon's choices made, we're just now learning the incentives, previously shielded from public view, that were on offer. Last week, Wake County released documents showing that it and the city of Raleigh had promised Amazon up to $277 million in incentives. Durham officials briefly contemplated incentives of up to $50 million, but never made an offer. Wake's contribution would have only been part of a small part of the total bid. The 2017 state budget allowed for transformative projects that invest $4 billion in the state to be reimbursed 100% of their corporate tax bill for a quarter century. Add to that other incentives and the state's help with infrastructure, and we'd likely be looking at billions of dollars. To a company like Amazon, currently valued at nearly $800 billion, and likely to be worth twice that within a decade, Wake's $277 million offer is small beer. So too is New York and Virginia's $2 billion. Amazon didn't base its decision on financial incentives. Instead, it located HQ2 in the cities that already have the highest concentration of Amazon workers outside of Seattle, and coincidentally, where Bezos already has houses. The competition was little more than a ruse to get the cities that were already going to win to cough up some dough, and to get the cities that weren't to cough up information about their economic development and infrastructure plans that Amazon can now use in its business planning. So, we all got played, y'all. Perhaps Amazon would have been worth it, perhaps not. But to find out, we would have had to give the world's richest man a few billion dollars after he pitted us against other cities that were vying to give him a few billion dollars to ensure that he had wrung every last dollar from taxpayers while sitting on a net worth north of $130 billion. That's with a B. That's more than just a morally indefensible version of capitalism. That's a sucker's game, and we never should have played. The next article, Kill the Mall. The decline and fall and possible reinvention of Northgate Mall. Although it was an unremarkable Thursday evening, Northgate Mall was buzzing. The Christmas decorations had recently been hung, imbuing the mall with an air of hope and expectation. Manufactured bushels of pine adorning in twinkling lights were suspended from the ceiling, appearing to levitate. At the flashlight barbershop, men pooled in chairs, making the kind of jilted, intimate small talk not uncommon among guys whose attention is divided between a football game and checking their reflections in the mirror. On the wall, a list of rules. No cell phones. No profanity. No sagging pants. One customer defiantly chattered on his cell phone, and the barber brushed the loose hairs off his neck. Around the corner at Esmeralda's Cafe, a couple shared a panini. Nearby, a toddler rode the carousel 2-3 times in a row. At Wyatt and Dad's Shoe Repair, a woman handed her clogs over to the cobbler with the cautious gentleness with which one might hand over a newborn baby. On the surface, it seemed like business as usual at the 58-year-old North Durham Shopping Center. Although the corridors were thin with people and many of the storefronts sat vacant, the warm fluorescence made the mall feel populated. But rolling beneath loomed uncertainty over the future of Northgate. Who would own it? And what would they choose to do with the historic space? Last month, a private equity firm called Northwood Investors got the legal go-ahead to begin foreclosure on the mall. Not even 6 months before, the firm had bought two promissory notes comprising the mall's $62 million in debt. Northgate Associates, the local company that owns the mall, defaulted. Now, if the mall either can't reach an agreement with Northwood or pay off its debt, the mall could face foreclosure at the end of the year. And that's left Durham locals, some who only wander in during the holiday season, others who grew up as teenage mall rats in its geometric atrium, wondering what will become of the sprawling complex, which has been a part of Durham's fabric since 1960. Will Northgate be the latest casualty of the retail apocalypse, yet another suburban mall whose shoppers have turned to Amazon or urban retailers? Or can Northgate reinvent itself again, as it's done several times in the past? And should the city begin eyeballing that property for something else altogether, something designed for the 21st century, not a relic of a bygone era of Americans' consumerism? This is extremely valuable land, says Mayor Steve Shule. It's located very near downtown. It's located on an interstate highway. Whether or not it remains in the hands of a local family, or whether or not it's taken over by Northwood, I think it's going to be a very important thing that that land be developed in a way that is beneficial to Durham. There are going to be a lot of important decisions made about that land, regardless of who the owner is. An invention of Austrian architect Victor Gruen, the shopping mall was born in 1956, envisioned as an alternative to Main Street. Northgate followed soon after, though developer J. Kennan Rand Jr., who had optioned the former Tobacken Field in 1949, originally intended that property for something else entirely, a Coca-Cola bottling plant. But he ran into opposition from people who, a half a century later, might be called, not in my backyards. The land existed in the interstices between present-day Waldown and Bragtown. Then there was an involved complaint built into the neighborhood. According to a 1949 Durham Morning Herald article, the nearby residents protested at a Planning and Zoning Commission meeting, and Rand's plans were thwarted. 8 years later, Rand announced that he would build a shopping center on the site. In the time between the rejected plant proposal and his new announcement, construction on the interstate began just a short distance away, making the lot an ideal location for a mall. In 1960, when it opened, the then strip mall was among the first of its kind. It featured a Roses, Kerr Drug, and Colonial Store supermarket. Within 2 years, it doubled in size, adding a movie theater and a restaurant in addition to 22,000 square feet of store space. It would continue to expand incrementally over the next decade. At a ceremony in 1974, Rand opened the enclosed mall we know today, complete with a carousel that still runs to this day. Among the new stores opening were Baskin-Robbins, The Curtain Shop, Chess King, Chick-fil-A, a B.B. Dalton Booksellers, Slacks and Things, Wrangler Ranch, and even a Spencer Gift, which is also still there. Suburbia is often credited with giving rise to the American mall. As consumers moved out of city centers, a white flight headed by the post-war economic boom, an influx of automobiles, and the construction of the interstate highway system, they needed alternative location to coalesce. Between 1960 and 1990, Durham's population nearly doubled, but its downtown was decimated by poorly managed urban renewal policies. But other factors played a role, including the Cold War. According to historian Timothy Mennell, Cold War anxieties fueled the design of the enclosed mall, which was typically miles from concentrated urban centers, fortified by concrete and steel and climate-controlled, protecting against a particularly harsh post-nuclear holocaust. In fact, many of the earliest malls were built with underground tunnels and fallout shelters. But the mall emerged from the Cold War in other ways, too. Part of how American capitalism exerted its dominance over communism was through a campaign of consumption, emphasizing the breadth of choices available through the free market. The rise of consumption became central to the rise of Northgate. Between 1975 and 2000, the mall continued to expand, adding a food court, another screen at the movie theater, and thousands of square feet in retail space. The shop was as American as apple pie. In early 2000, when sleek competitor The Streets of South Point opened in South Durham, Virginia Rand Bowen, Rand's daughter, who became the managing general partner of Northgate Associates in 1985, expressed optimism about Northgate's prospects, especially given its history in the Bull City. People don't give track record much credit, but it always does play a role, she told the Triangle Business Journal. We've been going strong for 30 years, and we're not going to roll over just because there's some new competition out there. But even its track record couldn't save Northgate from overarching economic trends. A decade before the Great Recession, malls were beginning to lose traction, especially those, like Northgate, that weren't seen as high-end and therefore safe. In 1998, Good Housekeeping warned readers of violent crime at these shopping centers in a feature titled Danger at the Mall. Crime was only part of the equation. So, too, was the proliferation of big-box discount stores like Walmart. And so was the proliferation of malls themselves. There were simply too many of them. Tax incentives encouraged the construction of malls even when there wasn't a demand for them. Americans were over-retailed, and though there were broad economic gains in the 1990s, during that same decade, the buying power of the middle class eroded, and with it, malls' popularity. At that time, it was difficult to tell whether those dark clouds amounted to a temporary lull or portended a permanent demise. Northgate's, which heralded the fact that it had had an Old Navy and a Disney store, was still going strong throughout the 90s. But soon after the turn of the century, and the year after the South Point Mall opened its doors, Northgate decided it was time to reinvent itself. In early 2001, according to court documents, Bowman and Northgate Associates took out a property-secured loan for $58.5 million. 6 years later, they took out a second loan for $27.5 million. Soon after taking out the first loan, Northgate spent $6 million on a facelift and then $13 million more on a full makeover, expanding the movie theater and shopping areas and the entertainment venues. That investment didn't appear to pay off. The story of the mall over the last decade and a half has been a story of closures, from Belk to Macy's, Office Depot to Guitar Center, Harris Teeter to S&K Menswear. While Sears declared bankruptcy earlier this year and announced that more than 180 of its stores would close, the Durham location has so far been spared. And so, to walk through Northgate today is to walk through a post-apocalyptic landscape, like walking through a world that is already over, a world where teenage indiscretion involved shoplifting a personality from the shelves of Spencer's Gift and Hot, and a world where cucumber melon was called a card for tween girls. A world where the first day of school demanded a new outfit. A world that promised that the American dream was in reach. You just had to buy it. The shopping mall, like an appendix, is a vestigial organ of American capitalism. Once emblematic of the abundance of consumer choice, it has been rendered nearly obsolete. Today, the decline of malls is often attributed to irrelevance in the post-recession Amazon retail economy, or the blossoming of newer and shinier mixed-use complexes. There's also the reality that malls like Northgate have become tawdry and uncool. Once the primary watering hole for teenage social savannas, they've fallen victim to desertification. Fewer teens frequent malls with each passing year. This is all true, but there's a caveat. Malls catering to rich people are still doing fine. Malls catering to everyone else are dying, a testament, perhaps, to growing inequality. While luxury malls like South Point flourish, one-third of the approximately 1,100 enclosed malls across America are dead or dying. Many of these dying malls have been converted into medical offices and clinics, megachurches, cultural community hubs, and community college campuses. Northgate, with its diverse middle-class clientele, seems headed in that direction. A Department of Motor Vehicles license agency sets between the New York Jewelry Shop and Ken's Tailor Shop. Reinvestment Partners temporarily inhabits a storefront during tax season, providing free tax assistance to local residents. Revolve Church meets weekly at the cinema. And the Durham Public Library houses its North Carolina collection and the Maker Lab at the mall. The fact that Northgate is and has always been locally owned and connected to the community it serves remains one of its strongest attributes. The introduction of Northwind investors could change all of that, marking a turning point in the mall's history. Northgate Mall has been locally owned forever, basically since it started. It's been owned by Jeannie, Rand Bowman, and her family, Shule says. They've been really extraordinary citizens of Durham. As a local mall, they had really contributed so much to the life of our city. So many local events are sponsored out of Northgate, and they help so many of our nonprofits. So I do have concern that a developer without that commitment to our community might not make the same sort of contribution. Northgate Associates and Northwind Investors did not respond to repeated requests for comment. Groups like Northwind Investors, which in June purchased the $62 million in debt that remained from the loans Northgate took out in the 2000s, has become familiar characters in the transformation of Durham, a sign that outside money is here to stay. Northwind is behind the new Palladian Apartments, the residential component of a burgeoning corporate center on the I-40 between Durham and Chapel Hill. Its portfolio also includes the office building at 555 Magnum and the downtown living experience, Van Allen. What its presence will mean for Northgate remains unclear. Despite the uncertainty, things are still happening at the mall, just not always things you'd think of as happening at a mall. Duke Health is proceeding with plans to locate offices and clinics in the former Macy's. The Durham Public Library plans to lease space there until the renovation of its main branch is completed in the early 2020. And while Northwind could foreclose within a few weeks, store managers say Northgate Associates has assured them that they can expect to keep their leases for at least another year. That's hardly a long-time guarantee, but for many of Northgate's small business owners, the American dream is still alive at the mall. Esmeralda Ayala immigrated to New York City from Honduras 24 years ago. She worked in restaurants for the decade she lived in Big Apple, and then for the first six in North Carolina. Eventually, she left her job in order to focus on her dream, opening a restaurant, Esmeralda's Cafe, across the way from Pretzel Twister and near a corridor of clothing stores. The cafe serves coffee, tea, baked goods, soups, and most famously, paninis. Ayala hopes to eventually include Honduran food on her menu. A lot of people go to South Point because it's bigger and seems fancier. But Northgate feels more family-oriented, says Brandon Rogers, a 24-year-old who grew up riding the carousel and now works part-time at both GameStop and Sears. Plus, it's the oldest mall in Durham. It's sad that people have left it, but I'm still here. Tony Wyatt and his brother used to work with their father in a successful chain of shoe repair stores in the 90s. After the dad retired, they founded their own chain, Wyatt and Dad Shoe Repair, and opened their second store in the Northgate Mall in May of 2017. Wyatt says they've already doubled their business. I don't know what the new owner's intentions are, but I do know the mall is still signing new leases, so apparently they aren't trying to tear it down, Wyatt says. I think it's going to be good when the dust settles. I'm very optimistic that it's going to be very good and the mall is going to turn around. Being in the shoe repair business, Wyatt is used to being told that an industry is dying. He doesn't traffic in such anxiety. I read articles in newspapers in the 1920s and things like that, and the argument was constantly, well, cheaper shoes are putting shoe repairs out of business. And that's not the case. The demand is still there, Wyatt says. Most of our customers do come for us because there's nobody else around. I think it's the same for malls like Northgate. The demand is still there. We now turn to the indie food section. Can Do. Holiday food drives help fight hunger, but Porch feeds hungry Triangle residents year-round. On a rainy November morning, more than 100 people are gathered in the parish hall at St. Thomas More Catholic Church in Chapel Hill, ready to be pressed into service. Tables are stacked high with canned goods, boxes of mac and cheese and jars of pasta sauce, $17,000 worth of non-perishable groceries, all donated by local residents. More than 2,000 paper bags donated by Harris Teeter are doubled up and waiting. An assembly line forms, and in less than 2 hours, the bags are packed and ready to be delivered to food pantries and families across Chapel Hill and Carrboro. The people packing bags are volunteers with Porch, a local hunger relief organization that spans hundreds of neighborhoods in the Triangle. While food drives are a familiar scene this time of year, Porch is active year-round. In Orange County alone, donations from 200 neighborhoods stock 15 pantries and hundreds of families. The magnitude of the outreach is even more impressive, given that Porch is a wholly grassroots organization facing complex logistics. It takes a holistic approach to fighting poverty, not only by feeding people, but also through community-building education and advocacy. Though it now has hundreds of volunteers, Porch started in Chapel Hill 8 years ago with three energetic and determined women, Christine Cotton, Susan Romaine, and Debbie Horowitz. Having seen the impact of food insecurity firsthand when volunteering in our children's classrooms and volunteering for other hunger relief organizations in town, we were inspired to start Porch, Horowitz said. We work in collaboration with other local nonprofits to fill a unique niche, giving fresh food access to many families falling through the cracks because of barriers of access to hunger relief resources. The founders started on a micro level, inviting their neighbors and friends to put a non-perishable food item on their porch on a designated day each month. A neighborhood captain collects the goods and brings them to a central location where they are sorted and redistributed to local charities, food banks, and families in need. This small-scale food drive has grown into a large outpouring of community CERT, including donations of supplies and services from local businesses. Some mornings there are fewer volunteers, less food. The summer months tend to have sparser participation with school out and families away. But there are always enough people to help and plenty to give. Our goal is to equalize donations over the course of a year, to provide a steady source of food. People aren't just hungry at Thanksgiving, Horowitz said. Unique to the Chapel Hill Carrboro Porch chapter is the Food for Families initiative, which benefits 400 food-insecure families. These families are 95% working poor, identified by school social workers, churches, and refugee relief workers. They are families on the margins who might not qualify for governmental aid, but for whom this monthly gift could make a huge difference. A week's worth of groceries from the porch might mean a utility bill gets paid or a holiday gift is affordable. Half of the non-perishable goods collected at the monthly sorting go to these families, which also receive fresh produce, milk, chicken, and eggs. This month, more than 8 tons of fresh produce, milk, eggs, chicken, and ground beef were delivered to 1,762 people in time for Thanksgiving and the school break. Porch has approximately $16,000 a month for these groceries, which come from individual donations, $40 can feed one family for a month, and some donations from vendors like Farmer Food Share and Maple Leaf Farms. Other fresh goods are purchased at a discount or in bulk from local supermarkets and wholesale warehouses like Cliff's Meat Market and Costco. Food for Families regularly solicits feedback from recipients to learn how they can be served better by Porch. From such surveys, they learned that Burmese refugees had little use for goods like peanut butter and preferred more bags of rice instead. The deliveries have also become a major source of community connections among recipients and volunteers who exchange recipes and share stories through translators. A free flea market often pops up at the distribution site with donations from Book Harvest and clothing from community members. At St. Thomas More, Romaine introduces a guest from UNC Horizons, one of the food pantries served by today's collection. UNC Horizons is a relatively new Porch partner. It's a residential and outpatient program for mothers or mothers-to-be or who are in addiction treatment. This allows women to maintain custody of their children, who are provided with daycare or attend Chapel Hill Carborough City Schools while they receive counseling and classes in parenting and recovery. Many members get assistance, such as the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, and the on-site Porch Pantry is a bridge for patients whose benefits haven't yet kicked in. Horizons volunteer Ashley Wilson speaks to the shame many of these women feel coming out of the addiction and the shock they experience when they learn that strangers are willing to help them. The work done today is a drop in the bucket. Collections take place across the state every month. Shoppers at Weaver Street Market are regularly asked to round up their purchase to the nearest dollar, with the extra cents going to Porch. Elmo's Diner will support Porch Durham on November 27th, and also given as a Giving Tuesday by donating 10% of all proceeds. New chapters are spreading through the word of mouth. It's as simple as neighbors helping neighbors, starting with as little as a can of tuna. And now from the indie music section, Open and Shut. At Bayou Cafe, it's in its respective music program downtown, a new venue emerges in Lakewood. Though there are no venues shuttering for now, tectonic shifts in Durham's live music scene are happening as the downtown hub for jazz ends its regular programming at the end of the year, and a new concert venue opens its doors in Lakewood. It would be easy to read these concurrent developments as further evidence of a rapidly gentrifying city, but if you ask the owners, the changes reveal more about their specific passions than they seem to reveal about the economics of live music in Durham. Bayou Cafe, which has been a staple of the Durham jazz community and a beacon of black business downtown since it opened in late 2009, recently announced in a Facebook post that the start of 2019 would mark the end of its live music programming. After much reflection on the changing landscape of downtown Durham and the evolving business model of Bayou, our owner, Dorian Bolden, has decided to make the difficult choice to refocus the business's efforts and energy on its original passion and scope, coffee, the post reads. In a word, Bayou Cafe is returning to its roots. Started by Duke alumnus Dorian Bolden, Bayou Cafe has evolved in the decades since its opening into a full cafe and a restaurant with breakfast, brunch, lunch, and dinner service with a bar, in addition to a live performance space. Many of the cafe's followers expressed dismay at the comments, accusing Bolden of catering to a changing demographic of downtown, a euphemistic way of saying that Bolden was turning his back on his longtime customer base in favor of attracting more white patrons. "I've been wrestling with this decision for a long time," Bolden said. "The saddest part and the hardest part of putting on live music wasn't that people don't realize that it takes to run a music production unless things go wrong. It was a choice between being a jack of all trades and a master of none, or picking a lane." Although the cafe is known for its live performances, the story penned by Bull himself on his website emphasizes his love of European coffee and how working at cafes in New York City prepared him to start Bayou. Even before he opened Bayou's doors downtown, Bolden was going to house parties with his heart and soul coffee blend to share his vision for this cafe. In 2016, as rents rose downtown, Bolden decided to move just a few storefronts down to its current location at 341 West Main Street. With financing from self-help, Bolden bought the space so the business would no longer have to lease from a landlord. Why it was such a diffuse decision is that I want to make sure we do have a place where we can celebrate another 10 years, Bolden said. I want to make sure this is a community gathering place and that we can continue to be a part of a downtown growth. Over the years, a slate of impressive and beloved musicians have performed in AU, including Branford Marsalis, Nyanya Freeman, and Cyrus Chestnut. It also was a space where many musicians honed their chops, whether up-and-coming percussionists or renowned vocalists. The cafe was also a staple avenue of the Art of Cool Festival, as well as in Duke performance programming. Cicely Mitchell, co-founder of the Art of Cool Festival, says she found out about the decision to end live music from social media. It came as a total surprise. I think that this poses a huge impact on the jazz and live music community, Mitchell said. There is an opportunity to see how resilient the community is. I am optimistic that the musicians, DJs, and audience will find or create a space to connect to live music very soon. The impact on the Jazz Forward Art of Cool Festival will likely be minimal because of its programming across several venues. But Bayou is still one less venue for the festival, and it's one less stage for jazz hopefuls across the Triangle. Bolden says he's sympathetic toward those who disagree with his decision. Bayou has provided music for as many years and is a part of many people's lives and memories. So yes, of course, there is anxiety, he says. Still, Bolden insists that this decision to focus on the communal coffee shop is good not just for the longevity business, but for the Durham community writ large. Let us remember that in April 2018, two black men were arrested in a Starbucks for doing absolutely nothing. Bayou Coffee was one of the top coffee shops listed as one of the places to go and support black business in the coffee industry, Bolden said. That goes to the importance of bringing together this space for safety and inclusion and diversity. Meanwhile, on Chapel Hill Road, a new venue for music will officially open on December 7th. Rhythms Live, owned by husband and wife Victor and Jerry Graham, the venue promises to re-expose our adult populations to the music they love and demand. Victor Graham says the venue is a culmination of a 20-year journey that began with a fortuitous childhood where he saw Elvis Presley and Jackson 5 back-to-back in the same audience as Johnny Cash and Jerry Lewis. And that happened on a Kiss performance when they were a lounge act at the Peabody Hotel in Memphis, Tennessee. And he met Earth, Wind, and Fire shortly after their first album. To Graham, all these encounters were a harbinger of a musical future to come. Something hit me. Some people call it an epiphany. Some people call it the Holy Spirit. And it led me on this long journey today to what we call Rhythms Live, Graham said. A self-professed country boy from South Carolina, Victor moved to Durham in the early 80s, straight out of college. I visited Durham for the first time in 1983, and the moment I saw Durham, I knew automatically, this is where I want to be. I could smell the opportunity in the air. He's lived there ever since. Before opening this venue, Jerry Graham, Victor's wife, was a banker. Graham himself still works with senior citizens, helping them with estate planning and insurance claims. Last year, faced with an empty nest and a looming retirement, the Grahams decided to move forward on Victor's decade-long dream to open up a music venue. I remember the day exactly, August 28, 2017, Graham said. It was the day he walked into the space that more than a year later would become Rhythms Live. The venue is located in the Lakewood Shopping Plaza near the Scrap Exchange. According to Victor, the Ruse Arts District played a pivotal role in the decision to move to the neighborhood. "They really embraced us and the concept," Graham said. "I was looking for them, and they were looking for me." Wabeo boasted low admission prices, usually under $20, and a range of shows from amateurs and seasoned professionals alike. Rhythms is actively courting an older audience for classic acts with a fully seated venue and much pricier tickets. Tickets for the venue's opening show featuring Blood, Sweat, and Tears are $60, which include an entree from the dinner menu as a grand opening treat. Rhythm also will have full dinner service and a bar. Victor Graham is especially excited that the venue will have free and accessible parking. The venue's early lineup shows includes country music singer Crystal Gayle, R&B artist Jeffrey Osborne, and Grammy-winning guitarist Larry Carlton. Graham says he believes that Rhythms Live is a good complement to existing venues, smaller than DPAC, but bigger than more intimate jazz clubs in the area, like Sharp 9 Gallery. "The music scene is just as strong as the music scene in the country," Graham said. "We feel as we grow, we hope we will be in a position to engage the community and serve it." And now a brief look at the back talk. In last week's paper, Jeffrey Billman wrote about North Carolina's democracy problem, how Democrats had won more votes in General Assembly races, but Republicans won more seats. On Twitter, Michael Cooper responded, "Thought this was great. Glad you mentioned self-sorting as an issue, too. But even with sorting, the maps are unfair, and our politics would benefit from healthy competition, not campaigns played to the base." Tim G., however, argues that neither gerrymandering nor self-sorting, that is, the tendency of liberals to cluster in urban neighborhoods while conservatives spread out elsewhere, explains the recent election results. "While gerrymandering is a problem, the idea that the spread of Democrat representation can result in more electoral votes but fewer votes just isn't correct." Well, that's about it for another week. This has been Bob Martin for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. And a reminder, this program will be available as a podcast following its initial broadcast. So until next week, goodbye, good night, and good morning.